The following is a class given by His Holiness Jayapataka Swami on May 2nd, 1986 in Los Angeles, California. The class begins with a reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam, 7th Canto, Chapter 12, Text 11.
It is sometimes misunderstood that a grihastha, a householder, is permitted to indulge in sex at any time. This is a wrong conception of grihastha life. In spiritual life, whether one is a grihastha, vanaprastha, sannyasi, or brahmachari, everyone is under the control of the spiritual master. For brahmacharis and sannyasis, there are strong restrictions on sexual indulgence. Similarly, there are strong restrictions for grihasthas. Grihasthas should indulge in sex life only in accordance with the order of the Guru. Therefore, it is mentioned here that one must follow the orders of the spiritual master. Guru Vritir Vikalpena. When the spiritual master orders, the grihastha may accept sex life. This is confirmed in Bhagavad Gita 7.11. Dharma Virudho Bhuteshu Kamosmi. Indulgence in sex life without disobedience to the religious rules and regulations constitutes a religious principle. The grihastha is allowed to indulge in sex life during the period favorable for procreation and in accordance with the spiritual master's order. If the spiritual master's orders allow a grihastha to engage in sex life at a particular time, then the grihastha may do so. Otherwise, if the spiritual master orders against it, the grihastha should abstain. The grihastha must obtain permission from the spiritual master to observe the ritualistic ceremony of garbhadana samskara. Then he may approach his wife to beget children, otherwise not. A brahmana generally remains a brahmachari throughout his entire life. But although some brahmanas become grihasthas and indulge in sex life, they do so under the complete control of the spiritual master. The kshatriya is allowed to marry more than one wife, but this also must be in accordance with the instructions of the spiritual master. It is not that because one is a grihastha, he may marry as many times as he likes and indulge in sex life as he likes. This is not spiritual life. In spiritual life, one must conduct one's whole life under the guidance of the Guru. Only one who executes his spiritual life under the direction of the spiritual master can achieve the mercy of Krishna. Yasya prasadat bhagavat prasada. If one desires to advance in spiritual life, but he acts whimsically, not following the orders of the spiritual master, he has no shelter. Yasya prasadan nagati katopi. Without the spiritual master's order, even the grihastha should not indulge in sex life. Thus in the Bhaktivedanta purports on the Srimad Bhagavatam chapter entitled The Perfect Society for Spiritual Classes, Canto 7, Chapter 12, Text 11. Translation. All the rules and regulations apply equally to the householder and the sannyasi, the member of the renounced order of life. The grihastha, however, is given permission by the spiritual master to indulge in sex during the period favorable for procreation. So, this is after describing the various responsible ways in which someone interested in spiritual life has to behave, part of which is how one should behave in relation with the opposite sex. According to the Varnashram system, society has been divided into social orders and spiritual orders, or ashramas. So Prabhupada has many times mentioned that three of the spiritual orders, sex life is completely forbidden: brahmachari, sannyas, banaprast, restricted completely. Banaprast, some association is allowed. Only in the grihastha ashram is a license given. But here we can understand that the license that's given is not a simply a kind of unlimited license, but there is also certain stipulations, rules and regulations. One is that sex life should be for procreation, the other that it should have the sanction of the spiritual master. Because the spiritual master is responsible to take the disciple back to Krishna. So therefore, increasing one's family situation, having more children, all these type of things should be consulted with the spiritual master. Someone may consider this is very strict, but the key is given here, is that if we follow these principles and act under the orders of the spiritual master, then we have shelter. In that case, whether one is a sannyasi or whether one is a brahmachari, one will be under the complete shelter of Krishna. The grihastha is allowed to indulge in sex life, but if he does so according to these principles, then he'll enjoy the same shelter of Lord Krishna. We found that Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, he would treat differently his sannyasis and his grihastha followers. We know that Chota Haridas, simply by looking at a wrong attitude, he rejected him, made a great example of him. Well, on the other hand, we saw that various grihasthas, like Shivananda Sen and others, if they had children, he would sometimes name the children, bless them, and so on. So, for grihastha, this was permitted. And Lord Chaitanya obviously gave them full shelter. Otherwise, he would not have gone to such an extent as a sannyasi to name their children, to bless them, ask to see the child, and so on. So, by this, Lord Chaitanya thoroughly authorized grihasthas who are following the regulative principles, who are acting under the order of Guru, to have children, and that they can enjoy the complete shelter of Krishna. So, the whole purpose of life is ultimately to achieve Krishna. If we don't lose sight in that, and if we actually keep that as our prime objective, then everything fits into place. Everything makes a lot of sense. If we lose sight that in this lifetime we want to achieve Krishna, then we'll lose sight of these principles. So someone who doesn't follow these principles, they may be devotees, but they may not achieve Krishna in this lifetime. They may not go back to Godhead in this lifetime. But if somebody follows these principles, then they are assured of success, barring that they follow all the other principles that the spiritual master has given. In other words, the grihastha, if they could strictly follow these principles, they can be assured also of going back to Godhead, although they're having sex indulgence. So that is something very significant, because in the Mayavadi Sampradayas, they say that if one wants to achieve moksha, the Shankaracharya followers, they say you have to be a sannyasi. Unless you're a sannyasi, you cannot achieve liberation, according to their philosophy. So that promotes sex indulgence for the non-sannyasis. Just like when you make something too difficult to achieve, then the tendency is that, well, since I can't do it anyway, then don't try at all. In this way, the Vaishnava philosophy is showing that Prabhupada said that actually devotion to Krishna is so powerful, it's so attractive, that it can attract people from their different situations. So even a grihastha can also become completely attached to Krishna, and if they follow these principles, then they can also go back to Godhead. So that's the difference between the Mayavadi philosophers and the Vaishnava path. The people, generally Indian people, don't understand this. That actually, if they follow the principle as a Vaishnava Grihastha, they can achieve complete perfection, just like Maharaj Ambarish did, just like so many other great Vaishnava Acharya Grihasthas did. Generally, they consider that just they understand the Mayavadi philosophy. That's the unfortunate thing, that since the time of Shankaracharya, Hinduism has been predominated by the Mayavadi philosophy. Lord Chaitanya's philosophy, we know, is supposed to replace the philosophy of Shankaracharya. That can only be replaced by the preaching of the followers of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. It doesn't get, in other words, we know that there's a cycle, that when people were falsely claiming Vedic rules to commit sacrifice, they are doing animal slaughter. The Buddha came, established the principle of ahimsa, got the people who actually were misusing Vedic regulations to stop their animal slaughter and follow something which was much closer to the intention of the Vedic principles. But superficially, he led them away from the Vedas. Then Shankaracharya came, and he led the people back to the fold of Vedic culture by preaching covered Buddhism. Then after that, of course, although various Vaishnava Acharyas have come and brought many people back to the fold of Vaishnavism, like Madhva Acharya, Ramanuja Acharya and others, but specifically, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is meant to bring everyone back to the fold of Bhagavad Dharma. But how is this to happen? This is to happen specifically through Lord Chaitanya's Sankirtan movement. Srila Prabhupada said that ISKCON is a branch of Lord Chaitanya's spiritual tree. ISKCON is representing Lord Chaitanya. Therefore, this responsibility falls squarely upon us to preach in such a way as to replace the Mayavadi principle of life, to establish firmly the Vaishnava principles. We know how Srila Prabhupada, we pray to him every day, Namaste Saraswati Devi Gauravani Pracharine Nirvisesha Sunyavadi Paschatra Deshatarine, that he is the Nirvishesh, the voidist, or the impersonalist, and Sunyavadi, the voidist, deliverer. He delivered all the people of the Western world, including the impersonalists and the voidists. Prabhupada was so concerned about negating this impersonal concept of spiritual life that actually that was the primal thing which is focused upon in his basic pranam mantra. He wants us to vigorously preach and establish the principle of the personality of Godhead. So part of that is that a person can perform Jukta Vairagya. Lord Chaitanya never approved of Shuksha or Shukha Vairagya, dry renunciation, where someone simply, he thinks, I have to do renunciation for renunciation's sake. It's a Niyamagraha. Rather, a person is to do renunciation for the pleasure of Guru and Krishna. And that renunciation is supposed to be in such a way that it's practically engaging in devotional service. This principle Lord Chaitanya taught, and that principle we can see how it's far more applicable in the Western world and the entire world today. First of all, who can be a sannyasi in this age and follow strictly the principle? It's very difficult. Practically hardly anybody can do it, very few, if any. It's not a principle which can be preached among society at large. But this principle of being a strict Krishna-conscious grihastha and engaging oneself in devotional service, either as a brahmana or as a kshatriya or a vaishya or a sudra, externally, but internally being completely dedicated to Krishna, this is the real principle of Daiva Varnashram. And this is something which the entire society can practice. When we come, we see that how the urgent need today is for the vigorous preaching of Krishna consciousness. There's nothing more important. Srila Prabhupada said we should consider as if a house is on fire. If a house is on fire, then somehow or another, the resident of the house, whether he knows the language, whether he can express himself properly, he gets the idea across, my house is on fire, you kindly come help put it out. He screamed, fire or something. Just through his enthusiasm, he gets the people to come and help to put out the fire. So the entire world is on fire. Especially wherever we go, people ask us, what is the solution to terrorism? What is the solution to the world situation? Especially in the third world, where people look up to India as a leader, it's very common to even have government officials come and ask, what is the solution for these things? You know, in America sometimes, people are a little bit proud, so they don't always ask the devotees, what is the solution? They already think they know the solution. That's even more dangerous, because they don't know the solution. So they're misleading people, like the blind leading the blind. But Srila Prabhupada specifically said that his mission was to purify the Americans and to establish the principle of God consciousness in America as the primal aspect. And this way, if there's any kind of dissension in the world, any kind of world, it should be on the basis of God consciousness versus atheism. It should be polarized. That is the duty that Srila Prabhupada gave to his American preachers. And since Prabhupada is, and everyone in the whole world can see that the situation is depending upon America and Russia. So this crucial situation, actually then the whole situation, we can see it's not polarizing on this basis, it's polarizing on other bases. Therefore, the American devotees of Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada have this massive responsibility to fulfill his instruction. Whether it's a grihastha, or a sannyasi, or whatever, the basic principle of spiritual life is to carry out the instructions as they're handed down through the disciplic succession. Our previous acharyas have given us instruction, those are handed down, those are further refined or applied by present day initiating gurus, by acharyas, and they give their disciples guidelines how to implement these. But our responsibility is to the previous acharyas to fulfill their instructions. Every member of the Krishna conscious movement is obligated to try to fulfill Srila Prabhupada's instructions, his orders, either as soon as possible, as far as possible. We don't have any other objective. This is what keeps us under the shelter of the disciplic succession. So, of course, for this purpose we need empowered devotees, devotees who are willing to follow these principles. Someone may be a devotee, be chanting, may not be following strictly the rules and regulations, may not be strictly adhering to these principles. So we may consider them as a devotee, Lord Chaitanya said. We can offer them respect in our heart. We should not intimately associate with them, except to preach to them. Someone who is following strictly the rules and regulations, who's initiated, we bow down to such people and call them as Prabhu. And for someone who's personally understood the conclusion of the Vedas and who is living those and teaching those to others, we offer them respect as acharya, and those who have not taken shelter, they take shelter of such advanced devotees to progress in their spiritual life. This is our principle. So in order to preach, to be a second-class devotee, at least to preach the movement of Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, we have to become strict. Otherwise, we won't get the force to change the hearts of people. So in this regard, in the time of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, there was once a grihastha, and his name was Chaitanya Das. You probably heard about him. And he was a bit old. He was maybe in 50s or so. Don't know exact age, but he was quite advanced in age. So they already practically accepted the Vanaprast. One day his wife said, however, maybe it was 40s, I don't know exactly the age, but they're a bit old. One day his wife said that, "I feel that we should have a child." And he said, the husband said, Chaitanya Das said, "What? At this age, now we're already just ready to finish our grihastha responsibilities. Now you're wanting to have a child?" And then, so she said, "I know what you're thinking, it's not that. But actually, I sincerely feel in my heart that Krishna wants us to have a Vaishnava child. I don't think it's just material desire on my part." So he said, he had a lot of doubt about this proposal. So somehow in discussing, they came to the conclusion, all right, let us go and ask Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, what does he want for us? So they were living in a place near Katwa, where Lord Chaitanya took sannyas. And they walked all the way down to Jagannath Puri. At that time, Lord Chaitanya was in Jagannath Puri. When they reached Jagannath Puri, entered into the town, they were approaching the Jagannath Puri temple. Just at that time, they were so fortunate that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu with his associates, Ramananda Rai, Sarup Damodar, Govinda Das and others, they were just walking out of the main gate of the Jagannath Puri temple. So immediately Chaitanya Das and his wife, I believe it was Lakshmi Priya, they offered their immediate obeisances just on the street there, prostrated obeisances he offered to Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. The Lord Chaitanya walked, when he got up to them, he stopped. Here there are two people, you know, paying their obeisances. Nobody can see, you know, just, I mean, so many people must be paying their obeisances to Lord Chaitanya. He stopped and turned to Govinda Das and said, "These are two of my devotees. You kindly see that they're taken care of and later bring them to see me." And he walked on. So immediately, because Lord Chaitanya recognized these two devotees, they became, you know, here Lord Chaitanya recognized two obvious grihastha devotees. There are so many sannyasis and other very big devotees, associates with him. All of a sudden, Lord Chaitanya stops and recognizes two devotees. No one ever seen them before. So immediately he became the object of great attention. Everyone know, "Who are you? Where have you come? What's, you know, who are these people that got this special mercy from Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu?" So they were given a place to stay, given Jagannath Prasad, taken for darshan. And they prayed to Jagannath, what was his desire. Then that night they took rest and they had a dream with Jagannath. Came in their dream and told them that was his desire that they have a child. They went to see Chaitanya Mahaprabhu before they could say anything. As soon as they came in, and they bowed down, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said that, "I want you to go back to your village and to have, you're going to have a child who is going to be a great devotee of mine. His name will be Srinivas." So they couldn't even ask anything. Before they asked anything, they got the order. So, nothing more needed to be said. They offered their obeisances and took the mercy of Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Then after remaining some time in Puri, they went back. And they were blessed with a son. So they named him Srinivas, according to Lord Chaitanya's instruction. So Srinivas and Chaitanya Das had a very close relationship. Chaitanya Das taught him all the principles of pure devotional service, whatever he had learned. So one day his son asked, "How did you get the name Chaitanya Das?" So then Chaitanya Das started to explain that actually he was, before Gangopadhyaya, he was a Brahmin and he had the name, another name. So he was going, he decided he wanted to go and see Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So on the way he went via Katwa. Just at that moment, he saw huge crowds of people. He said, "What's happening?" And they said, "Well, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is here." He said, "I'm going to Navadvip to see Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, and the Lord Chaitanya is here?" He said, "Yes. What's he doing here in Katwa? He's never come to Katwa before." "Oh, he's come here to take sannyas from Keshav Bharati Maharaj." So then he went, and there he saw Lord Chaitanya seated. He saw the entire Leela. He saw of how Lord Chaitanya had his hair cut, how the barber came. Lord Chaitanya called the barber and said, "Cut my hair." The barber, all the people started crying. They couldn't think Lord Chaitanya's beautiful hair, his beautiful, that they'd be cut. The barber started shaking. He said, "I can't do it." Lord Chaitanya got angry at him. He said, "You must do it. You're the barber. Cut the hair." So getting the order from Lord Chaitanya, then he came and started to shave Lord Chaitanya up. Soon as the hair was cut, he putting the knife to the hair, all the people there in the back, all the women, they started, "Oh, no, no!" They're just beating their heads and screaming, and people fainting. And they couldn't, I mean, they just went completely uncontrollable, thinking that Lord Chaitanya would go through this austerity. You see. Then Lord Chaitanya went to the Ganges, took a bath. He came to the kirtan, and everybody started chanting so ecstatically, he started spinning around, and tears were shooting from his eyes, just like coming from a syringe, drenching the people. There were such ecstatic symptoms were present. Everyone became very ecstatic. And suddenly Lord Chaitanya stopped. He called over Keshav Bharati and said that you should give me initiation. Then he asked, "Do you know the mantra?" He said, "This one you're going to give me." Then he pulls him over and gives him the sannyas mantra in the ear. So technically, Keshav Bharati was initiated into the Vaishnava order of sannyas by Lord Chaitanya beforehand. And then Keshav Bharati, just like we take Ganges water, offer it to the Ganges, he took that mantra and gave it back again to Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. After giving the sannyas mantra, then he had to give a name. So he said, "Your name is Sri Krishna Chaitanya." So when he said that, the entire crowd just exploded with kirtan. At that time in the front, just watching this whole thing, on his way toward Navadvip, very silly, was this Brahmin, Gangapadai. He was seeing, or Bhattacharya, that he was seeing, when he heard that, Sri Krishna, he just went into complete trance. And for days he just wandering around, Sri Krishna Chaitanya, Sri Krishna Chaitanya. He couldn't stop. The whole experience was so intense that he was just in complete absorption. And he just sit day and night, Sri Krishna Chaitanya. So he got the name Chaitanya Das. So while he was explaining this to his son, when he thought of that, he's Sri Krishna Chaitanya, he is sitting there, he went again into samadhi, and he just feeling intense separation for Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, tears pouring from his eyes, he just fell over in trance. And then, seeing his father, while his father was saying this, that Srinivas was feeling such separation, while his father was just passed out in trance chanting Sri Krishna Chaitanya, he was fell down at his lotus feet and grabbed his father's feet and put it on his head. And he was saying Sri Krishna Chaitanya. Then hearing him fall over, the wife came in to see what is happening. There he sees husband is on the ground, completely in trance, and sees the son is lying down, grabbing the father's lotus feet, and this is the type of family life they were having. So, Srinivasacharya, we know his, later on he wanted to find Lord Chaitanya, and that's of course is a huge history, how he would just miss finding his spiritual master, and how he was put into intense separation, till finally he got shelter of the six Goswamis, those who are remaining of the six Goswamis in Vrindavan. Now, he was the first one to start book distribution. But it's interesting because here we can see how Lord Chaitanya even personally ordered a grihastha to have a child, and how he sent them such an empowered preacher, Srinivas Acharya, liberated soul, to spread the Krishna conscious movement. So similarly, we actually need such pure souls to take up leading responsibilities in preaching Lord Chaitanya's message. Certainly some of the devotees who don't go back to Godhead, they would be very fortunate if they can take birth again in a family of devotees and get the opportunity. Those who were not born in a family of devotees know how much time is wasted in materialistic activities and materialistic trainings, which are simply distractions to our spiritual life. How fortunate it is to be able to be born in a Krishna conscious family, we cannot imagine what a great opportunity that is. And especially if the Garbhodan Samskar is properly performed, if one is acting under the order of Guru, according to the principles, then the door is open for such a Krishna conscious soul to take shelter. Of course, no one can guarantee that every soul is going to be a pure devotee, but at least the door is open for that opportunity. Bhaktivinoda Thakur had, correct me if I'm wrong, I believe he had 13 children. And of course, they were all engaged in Krishna's service. He engaged everyone. In fact, he was strict. So long as they were dependent upon him, minors, he said that if you want me to feed you, you have to help me in my devotional service. This is part. He wasn't sentimental in that way. But of course, he provided very nicely for his children. He also gave them the best he had to offer. He gave them not only their material needs, but he also gave them Krishna consciousness. You find in India that although people are devotees of Krishna, generally they just think about getting their children a college degree, getting them some kind of education, but they don't give them a spiritual education. As a result, the modern youth in India is far more deeply engrossed into Kali Yuga than the previous generation. And for instance, I had a disciple who wanted to become a devotee, but his parents came and their mother was rolling on the ground, contorting, just crying, that just let my son get his master's degree. Already got a bachelor's. Then after that it would be PhD. Just like they say, this is for our society, must have education, has to get a degree. Without this, everything is lost. And this is the thing, is that they think that we have to give our education to our child. It's our responsibility to bring up our children properly. At least they have that feeling. But then they think that means getting them a degree in some institution. Whether they use it or not, simply, all right, you have a degree. It's like a status symbol or something. And in this way, they waste so much time. It's in some cases where they don't need such a degree, or where they don't. The real thing is that the parents should not only consider that, all right, they may need, for those who are going to be in society working, they may need some degree, but the most important thing, they need a Krishna conscious education. That, unfortunately, they're not, although they're believing in Krishna, they don't understand this point. So that's our big endeavor there, is try to make the Grihastha public of India feel responsible for giving spiritual knowledge to their children, which is what they're really missing out. They're not getting. In fact, you'd be surprised that in India, if a person will wear a sikar and tilak to his school, that the teachers, more than anyone else, criticize that student. They feel challenged or something, that why this person is acting as a saint or something, and they'll deride the student in many cases. That you think it's this or that, and that encourages the other students to also harass. So it takes a very brave person to go to the normal public school and wear tilak. In India, even. Take a tremendous, in fact, even sometimes in the village, if someone wear neck beads, the other kids will start pulling on them. You know, when we think of India, we have so many sentimental ideas, but practically the situation is that you can do a little religion, but if a person actually wants to go full on and do pure Vaishnavism, there are a lot of little demoniac people who are there to antagonize and criticize and not to let one go forward. So like in our Namhat preaching now, we have so many people practicing in their homes. Sometimes they have to endure tremendous obstacles. One grihastha couple, Brahmin by birth, has a temple. When they took initiation from ISKCON, all the local Brahmins boycotted them and had their children surround the house and keep him under house arrest because said, "You have now become a Christian. But you took initiation from ISKCON. Is that Christians? They're all Christians." He's trying to preach to them that they're not Christian. They're devotees of Krishna. They're universal. They're beyond all this type of sectarian viewpoint. But they're pure Vaishnavas. They won't listen to him because he's a junior Brahmin. So they said, no, you've become polluted. Now he can't let you out. He can't go out and even get his crops, nothing. He's under. So and somehow he gets a message out. Actually, some devotee went to see him. He wrote a secret message and he said, "Hide this and take it out and give it to our Namhat preacher." So then he got the letter, Namhat preacher, that I'm under house arrest. They won't let me leave. They're all the local brahmanas. So then our preacher had to go there, challenge them, pull out the Shastra, quote all their references. Who is a qualified guru? Who is qualified to... What is a definition of a Vaishnava and so on? So they couldn't answer the question, the points presented by our ISKCON preacher. So gradually they started fading off. Although as soon as the preacher left, they little tried to restrict and they preached against our local Namhat devotee there. But they didn't keep him under. They didn't have the guts to keep him under house arrest anymore. Then. I went there with a whole party of people. We had a big panel. We did a program with drama, the Chadubar Prabhu's movies, lectures, the whole. Then I asked all the people to chant at least one round a day Hare Krishna, sign the Samskar Patra, little cards I give out for people who agree to chant one round a day. Got a few hundred people to agree to chant. Then I gave all those names to the person and said, "Now you make these people part of your local Namhat group, your folk program, and this way you can have your fill." So in this way, by a blitzkrieg coming in there, the few Brahmins were won over, and the ones that weren't, they had to recede because every person in their village practically had already signed from me to chant Hare Krishna. And then they got everybody to be part of that Namhat group, and now it's one of the more prosperous, successful Namhat groups. They have a daily Mangal Arti, morning class, Tulsi Puja, entire ISKCON program every day of the year there in their village under this devotee's supervision. He just came with a whole group of people for Namhatta annual Mela or congregation in Mayapur. So like this there, although they're grihasthas, they're brahmanas, but even in India, people are against Vaishnava principle in some of the places. Not everywhere, but in some of the places we meet this opposition. So there's opposition everywhere for establishing eternal Dharma principles. But at least there, you have to, of course, there you have to know the Shastra, you have to be able to argue, quoting extensively from the various scriptural references to establish these priorities amongst the pandits. But the most powerful thing is the Harinam Sankirtan. So here in America, there are also obstacles. But maybe here the obstacles, there are other kinds of demons. Maybe here there are more heavy or more a different kind. In India, we don't expect it. It's a bit shocking. Well, here, we expect to find opposition because this is, as Prabhupada, I was just reading, this is, he said, "I've come to America to find the root of the material disease. It's already spread to India, so I'm trying to find the root. Where is it coming from? Where is the root of Kali Yuga's strength? And so I've come here to America. Here's the root." So I want to cut it at the root. Then the entire world can be very easily Krishna conscious. So you are very fortunate to have this responsibility you're here at the root where Kali Yuga is getting maximum strength. And from this place you can also spread the maximum Krishna conscious influence over the entire modern world. Everyone is looking one way or another towards America, whether in admiration or in hate or in some way or another, everyone's looking. And of course, they set the standard for material enjoyment in many spheres. So similarly, if they actually take up, Prabhupada's dream was that people in America should take up this practice of Krishna consciousness. If they take it up using Prabhupada's program of Daiva Varnashram, brahmanas and preachers staying in our communities, those who cannot follow strictly, or those who are living in society and trying to practice from there, they preach from there and support the preaching movement from their homes, under the guidance and under the coordination of the full-time brahmana preachers who are working from our various temples. This program Prabhupada has repeatedly given us. Now if we can implement it through massive book distribution and then through the Daivarnashram program of engaging the people to chant the holy name, then we can gradually see the face of America change. And I'm always inspired to see how many programs, usually a lot of the programs are initiated here in New Dwarka and in the Southern California area. So this is also inspiring. Here, of course, the people are reputed to be, in general, a little more open-minded than, say, some other parts of the United States, like Georgia and Alabama. Are there any questions?
Dry
renunciation. Well, in terms of how to preach to different people, I mean, every person asks a question. It's according to Kaldesha and Patra. When you're talking to the person, then Krishna inspires one how to preach to the person so you don't turn them away. At the same time, you give them the maximum amount of Krishna consciousness they can take. We are not pro this one or pro that one. We're simply preaching Krishna consciousness. From one point of view, the whole situation is such, as Prabhupada said, that it's a hopeless situation. That the terrorists, they're not acting according to any principles as far as the retaliation. It's just a reaction and a counter-reaction. Because people have lost their consciousness of God. In the name of religious things, they're actually bringing, they're doing so many political movements. The Palestinian movement is not a religious movement. They're political activists who are trying to get a homeland or whatever, according to whatever bit I've been able to understand about their thing. They don't have anywhere to live as such, their own place. It's not a Muslim matter. It's not a jihad. It's not a sacred war. But it's a political thing. They need a place. It's a political, they're fighting for land. It's a normal kind of a political thing. But somehow, all these struggles are brought down, you find in Lebanon, it's Muslim versus Christian versus Jew. And the whole thing is brought to a religious sectarian viewpoint. But actually, it has nothing to do with religion. It has nothing to do with service to God. Simply, religious sentiment is being exploited by leaders in the world to engage people along certain political ends. Or even local leaders or local people, the local leaders in Northern Ireland, someone to be part of Ireland, so they exploit the people's religious sentiment that you're Catholics. Some people want to be part of England, so they exploit the other sentiment, you're Protestants. And the people, they hate each other. They're trained up from birth that Protestants in Northern Ireland are to hate Catholics, and Catholics are to hate Protestants, and so on. So the basic thing in South Africa is political. It's not a question of black or white, it's a question of political survival for certain people that they've created all these various ideologies. So in this way, whether religion or various other system, we find that for certain political purposes, people sometimes they use religion as a scapegoat or use it as a means to achieve their end. But in the actuality, where is the real religion? Where is the God? If there's God consciousness, if there's human life, then these things don't happen. Prabhupada said in response to what is the solution for terrorism, he said there is no solution. So long as people are not human beings, as long as they're not trained to actually be human beings in a real sense of spiritual understanding, then if the jungle so many animals fight with each other, if one tiger attacks one deer or one hyena attacks a rodent, who is going to complain? Who worries about that? But practically speaking, the human society is going down to the animal level. Therefore, innocent people are just slaughtered in the airports, or therefore people can indiscriminately do other things, where other innocent people might also be injured. According to, if the actual cult, like now they passed the resolution, the American government, that you can't kill another head of state. But if you study like Chanakya, if the head of state is the actual guy at fault, I mean, they don't want people trying to assassinate them, so they made a rule that we won't assassinate other heads of state. But if a head of state is responsible, we found that sometimes the king would, sorry, to come out and fight, and the two head of states would fight. Or sometimes they would. The Chanakya did some far out things where he just went directly for the head of state. Or just like in the Mahabharata, we find that Bhima, he went and challenged Jarasandha. He's the actual culprit. What's the use of killing his army 21 times? The actual guy who's starting the whole thing is Jarasandha. Ravana, he sends out his whole family, killing everyone killed, but actually the whole crux of the thing is simply Ravana. So finally Rama just gives one right in the heart of Ravana. And then the whole thing's finished. So if they really think that some one person is responsible, whatever he may be, according to Kshatriya codes, there's a lot of things you can do when you're, and what the code of ethics that they follow are a little bit puritanistic compared to the code of ethics given in the Vedas. According to the Vedas, a Kshatriya can do a lot of things which present public opinion would say is not proper. Violence at certain cases is possible. Now, for us to go, we don't go into this judging. It's very difficult for us because the whole issue is that what do we have to base it on? Two newspapers? You know, who can believe what the newspapers say anyway? I mean, you can't rely on that. You know, if you read the newspapers in India, if you read the newspapers in America, if you read the newspapers in Malaysia, I just came through the three, you'll find three different newses. And depending on which newspaper you read, if it's a leftist newspaper in India, because you got it there, left, right, middle, everything, then you get a total, you know, where in America, there's somebody's a hero, another place, somebody is described as the second mad dog, and you know, have, you know, complete different perspective according to various political outlooks and so on and so forth. So rather than getting into the jungle of trying to defend or counter it, a king or a head of state has the right to defend his people. Now, who's the aggressor? If somebody is an aggressor, they have a right to defend according to the code book of Manu. So then you have to ascertain who is the actual aggressor and get the aggressor. If there's an aggressor who's attacking you, then you have a right to defend yourself against that aggressor. And if innocent people get killed, then of course that's not supported by Vedic principles. In fact, there only the Kshatriyas would fight. This whole idea of guerrilla warfare, terrorism, is completely against the Vedic principles. So you go and just start bombing indiscriminately people just to get your our point of view put in the newspapers. It's another form of world insanity that we're seeing. And people have no respect for God, they have no respect, therefore, for human life. So the thing to preach is basically that the real problem in the world is not is the lack of Krishna consciousness. That's the real problem. Whether an Arab person asks you, or whether I generally try to do is take it off of the specific issue, which is like a trap. They just want to get you into discussing they want a chance to discuss their political viewpoint and taking it to a higher level, and then discussing it. And if necessary, finding the good and bad points on both the sides, Once we have firmly established that there is a higher principle which is being neglected in the world today, and then we can analyze from that principle, then you can, everything becomes very clear. But from their point of view, you think everything is very clouded, is very relative. But in general, we would say that if someone has the right to do something against an aggressor, but now you have to define who is the aggressor, whether what is done is the proper thing, that's another thing. Regarding your question, what is suksha vairagya? Suksha vairagya or sukha vairagya, dry renunciation, is where someone simply renounces something, just like someone thinks that I have to be suffering. Some people think that, you know, unless I'm complete, you know, in some very austere situation, this is like hurting me, then, you know, I'm not properly situated. So they do this type of excessive austerity. Just like if you give a person a big feast because it's a Janmashtami, day after Janmashtami, then they think, you know, I can't, it's like I have to, can't enjoy it because it's, you know, I have to be in vairagya, I have to be suffering or something. No. We take as a Krishna's mercy. For us, fasting and feasting is the same. One day we fast, next day we feast. We take it. We don't do austerity just for austerity's sake, without any higher purpose. You see, there are some that are very, they're over attached, and there are others who are over whimsical, over loose. So we have to find a middle point. Not simply to be austere for the sake of austerity alone, and not for any higher purpose or a higher benefit. It's not that a person has to dislike what he's doing. Rather, Krishna conscious susukam kortam abhyam, it's very joyfully performed. So if someone is performing devotional service, they should get some transcendental happiness from that. It's not that you have to dislike it. Although sometimes we may have to do some thing that we don't like to do for the purpose of achieving Krishna consciousness. That is vairagya. But that doesn't mean that everything we do we have to dislike it, by definition. And there are some taking the extreme fanatical situation, where some people, they always they're trying to be very, very austere, and they're eating or they're sleeping or various things. Rather, we have to be regulated and do things in a more sensible manner. That is what Lord Chaitanya recommended. Rather than just doing something, like someone said, I have to walk up to the mouth of the Ganges, on one side of the Ganges, circumambulate, come back down the other. One disciple of Bhaktisiddhanta Saitakura did that, and Bhaktisiddhanta rejected him. What is this? This is a dry kind of, you know, we do something because it's for Krishna, not because just we're doing something to be renounced. What's pleasing to Krishna, that we do. What's not pleasing, that we avoid. That is our renunciation. Is that clear? Hare Krishna.